Welcome to Prison Pipeline, produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. The Office of District Attorney is an elected position, and in the upcoming May election, Washington County voters have two choices. My guest is Brian Decker, candidate for District Attorney of Washington County, Oregon. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Brian, talk about your background.
I've been a public defender for over 4 years here in Washington County, which means I've been the defense lawyer who's appointed to represent people who can't afford to hire their own lawyer when they're accused of crimes. I have also been a federal prosecutor in the Justice Department during the Obama administration, which means I've been the lawyer who has charged people with crimes in federal court. I have also volunteered to represent victims of domestic violence when they are seeking restraining orders against people who have harmed them. I have volunteered to represent detainees at Guantanamo Bay back in the day. And so over the course of my career, mainly focusing on criminal justice, I've worked in many different roles in the justice system and seen things from many different perspectives. And what I've seen is a need for a balanced approach in the criminal justice system, something that incorporates some meaningful reforms, because the system as it exists, the status quo, is causing a lot of harm and a lot of bad outcomes for a lot of communities, in particular here in Washington County.
A county district attorney is given an enormous amount of discretion within the law. In the upcoming May election, why should Washington County voters give this responsibility to you?
Well, that's exactly right. And I recognize that it is a tremendous power and a tremendous responsibility that comes with this position of district attorney. The district attorney, as the lawyer in charge of the office that prosecutes all the crimes in the county every single year, gets to set the policies that make the decisions that drive the outcomes of all of those thousands of cases. So decisions about what crimes to charge, the number of crimes, their severity, decisions about whom to charge, decisions about whether or not to dismiss the case, what plea bargain they're going to offer, and whether that's something that drives somebody toward incarceration or drives somebody toward rehabilitation and treatment, what sentence they're going to recommend, and whether or not to request cash bail or insist on keeping somebody in jail before they've had their day in court. Collectively, all of those decisions are what the law calls prosecutorial discretion. In Washington County, we prosecute over 9,000 cases every single year. And in every single one of those 9,000 cases, the DA's office gets to exercise prosecutorial discretion. Even that number of cases, 9,000, is a product of the DA's office deciding and exercising that prosecutorial discretion, determining what kinds of cases they're going to prioritize and what kind of cases they're going to ignore. Most cases nationwide never go to trial. They end up with a plea bargain. And it's over 90% of cases nationwide. Here in Washington County, it's almost 97% of cases that end in guilty pleas. And in those cases, it's not a jury that decides the outcome. It's not even really a judge that decides the outcome. It's the decisions of the district attorney about what crimes are being charged, what pleas are being offered, what sentences are being recommended that determine what specific sentence is going to happen in that case and whether the person is going to be incarcerated or treated and rehabilitated. All of which is to say that this prosecutorial discretion, if it is wielded fanatically, as I have seen it be wielded here in Washington County, it can drive up mass incarceration. It can coerce guilty pleas. It can waste tax dollars. It can ruin lives. It can gut neighborhoods. And when used reasonably, as I intend to use it, prosecutorial discretion can reverse those trends and move the community forward by prioritizing rehabilitation and prevention.
And as you said, Brian, for the past 4 years, you worked as a public defender in Washington County. Now, do most DAs have this experience, and why is it important?
Most district attorneys don't, at least historically. The kinds of people who end up becoming your district attorney stay as the district attorney for decades and then pass the baton to the next in line at the office. And that's what we've seen for the past several decades here in Washington County. And that's what we have now in Washington County is an elected DA in Kevin Barton, who was the second in command to the previous DA. And he's largely spent his entire career in that one office, doing that one job, working his way up and seeing things from that very narrow perspective. Now, there are district attorneys who have diverse experience and who bring something more to the table when considering the full scope of the district attorney's powers. So I look across the country and at places like Northern Virginia, suburban Denver, suburban Chicago, Athens, Georgia. These are places where folks who have served as either public defenders or civil rights attorneys, somebody who has other experience in the criminal justice system, bring something new and suggests that we can effect some real change through the district attorney's powers rather than just maintaining the status quo, rather than just continuing to drive it in the quote unquote tough on crime, war on drugs, same direction that we've seen things go since Nixon, Reagan, you know, Willie Horton ads and Donald Trump, that same kind of regressive rhetoric of criminality and fear that has gotten us to where we are today.
In 2019, and over the objections of most prosecutors, Oregon legislators passed Senate Bill 1008, which changed the way juveniles convicted of aggravated murder get sentenced. There is no longer life without parole. They are now eligible for second look hearings after years in prison. Senate Bill 1008 was not retroactive, so Oregon Governor Brown may use her clemency powers to allow people convicted as youth who are not eligible for these hearings to apply for clemency. So Washington County DA Kevin Barton opposes releasing these individuals who he says were convicted as juveniles of violent crimes such as murder, rape, assault, and manslaughter. Do you support giving individuals a second look hearing and possible release?
I absolutely support looking back at these old cases that were handled under a different law. And now that we have changed the law to recognize what science has been telling us, which is that youths have brains that work differently than adults, that the juvenile brain doesn't fully develop until age 25 in boys, particularly in areas of executive function that affect decision-making, impulsivity, peer pressure, risk-taking, the kinds of things that lead to criminal behavior in a lot of cases. Now that we do recognize that, we have gone ahead and changed the law. And 1008 does, you know, the things that you were saying. 1008 also reformed the way that we charge juveniles with other serious crimes as well, because instead of naturally filing them and charging juveniles as adults with mandatory minimum sentences, now they always start off in juvenile court. And if a district attorney believes they, in a particular case, that it warrants treatment as an adult, then the district attorney goes to a judge and tries to prove it. 1008 is a sensible reform and a needed reform to give a path to rehabilitation for juveniles that were not afforded an opportunity under that same old regime of decades past. And it is no surprise that Kevin Barton is using the rhetoric of fear to complain about any steps that might be taken to allow youths to petition for a chance at a second look, to go into court and ask to show that they deserve to be let out early and put on supervision instead of finishing out these long adult prison terms that they had been sentenced to under an earlier regime. Kevin Barton opposed 1008 juvenile justice reform when it was taken up and passed at the legislature. He's continued to rail against it since then. He is the most vocal opponent to any sort of criminal justice reform statewide, where it is a kind of reform that would reduce his leverage to wield his prosecutorial discretion in a fanatical way and try to coerce as many guilty pleas and get as many convictions as he possibly can. Anytime you hear that there is a reform being contemplated by the legislature or by the voters by ballot measure, and you wonder who's going to be on the opposition side, you pick up the phone and call Kevin Barton, because he's the one who's on the opposition side. He's the one who gets interviewed on the news every single time with this rhetoric of people should be very afraid of criminals and we need to crack down on them, instead of the more level-headed, sensible reforms that we've seen have actually helped promote safety and promote health and stability in society in recent years.
And some of the reasons youth are serving harsh and excessive sentences is our mandatory minimum sentencing, which fundamentally shifted power from the judges to the district attorneys. But in recent years, some Oregon DAs have voiced their opposition to Measure 11, which is Oregon's one-strike-you're-out mandatory minimum sentencing law. So would you actively work to repeal or reform Measure 11?
Yeah, I recognize that the kinds of crimes that are listed in Measure 11 are the most serious crimes and more often than not deserve the most serious consequences. And we need to hold people accountable who commit those crimes. But here's the problem with mandatory minimum sentences. When people look at that list of crimes, when voters look at that list of crimes, when legislators look at that list of crimes and think, what is a robbery in the second degree? They picture the archetype. They picture, two people holding up a convenience store, right? They picture what you might see in the movies as a robbery in the second degree. And there's a disconnect between what you imagine when you're a voter and a legislator picturing that list of crimes and the decisions that the district attorney makes when exercising prosecutorial discretion. When the district attorney is examining a case, if what they're trying to do is to get as many convictions and get people into prison and jail as much as possible, then what they're going to do is charge as serious a crime as possible to fit whatever facts come in, which means when they look at a case coming in, they look not at the archetype of robbery in the second degree, they look at the least culpable possible case that they can conceivably fit into robbery in the second degree. And so in Washington County, I've seen multiple cases where, for example, you have two 18-year-old high school students after school, jump and punch some other kid in their class and run off with his backpack. I'm not saying that's good behavior. That's bad. That is hurting people. That is harming people. And that means people need to be held accountable for that. But that gets charged as robbery in the second degree on the theory that you can meet those elements of that Measure 11 offense. And robbery in the second degree has a mandatory minimum sentence of around 6 years. Nobody thinks that some 18-year-old who's never been in trouble before in his life with the law needs to go to prison for 6 years. Nobody, not even the regressive district attorney who charges robbery in the second degree on those facts, thinks that that kid deserves to go to prison for 6 years. But they charge it anyway because it gives them the leverage to coerce that kid into taking whatever plea bargain they're willing to offer. It takes the power away from the judge and from any other actor in the system to determine what the outcome of the case is going to be, because the district attorney controls whether that gets charged with a mandatory minimum sentence that is completely unacceptable and unjust in the eyes of everybody, or take it or leave it, take the plea bargain that you're given. And that's why we see so many of these cases, 97% of cases in Washington County have no day in court at all and instead get a plea bargain. So that's the real purpose of mandatory minimums, is to give that power to district attorneys to wield their prosecutorial discretion in this fanatical way. And that needs to stop. I was in juvenile defense my first year in Washington County as a public defender. I was representing teens and preteens who were charged as quote unquote juvenile delinquents. And I saw teens charged with felonies for things like driving their parents' car without permission or borrowing their parents' credit card without permission, on the theory that borrowing a credit card without permission constitutes fraudulent use of a credit card, which is a felony. And I'm not going to say, again, that that's good behavior. That is misbehavior. Teens should not be using their parents' credit card without permission. But it doesn't need to be criminalized. It doesn't need to be felonized. We don't need to be institutionalizing youth for typical adolescent misbehavior. And yet, that's exactly what the Washington County District Attorney has been doing. In fact, the rate at which the district attorney formally charges youths as juvenile delinquents, as opposed to diverting them into community service or any sort of alternative to incarceration and prosecution, the rate at which they get formal charges as delinquents has increased 53% in just the first 3 years of Kevin Barton's term. We are going in the wrong direction. We are going in the hyper-incarceration, mass incarceration direction, even when it comes to youths, because of this fanatical misuse of prosecutorial discretion.
In March 2018, Albert Molina was arrested for allegedly riding a bicycle while intoxicated. During booking in the Washington County Jail, Deputy Ryan Alden brutally assaulted Albert Molina. In a video of the incident, the assault appears unprovoked, and Molina suffered a traumatic brain hemorrhage, a skull fracture, and other injuries, and he was awarded $625,000 by Washington County. So District Attorney Kevin Barton failed to take immediate action against Deputy Ryan Alden. What steps will you take to hold law enforcement accountable?
Well, look, we've got to hold everybody who commits a crime accountable, and nobody should get special treatment. Not law enforcement, not corporations, not wealthy, well-connected people. We've got to treat everybody equally. And historically, the problem has been that law enforcement has a very well-connected relationship with the district attorneys who make these decisions. Law enforcement police officers tend to be witnesses in a lot of cases. They tend to be the investigators who district attorneys will say, you know, can you go interview this person? Can you go collect more evidence for this particular case? So they have a very cozy working relationship. And that means historically they've been sort of lucky enough to be in the in-group that will get the benefit of the doubt from district attorneys making charging decisions and all their other discretionary decisions that the general public doesn't get, that poor people don't get, that Black and brown people don't get. And that's got to change. We've got to immunize against that cozy relationship between prosecutors and police in order to hold police accountable in the same way that we hold everybody else accountable. You know, police are human beings, just like other human beings. Some of them commit crimes, but they don't deserve special treatment. In fact, when some police commit crimes, it's worse than when the general population commits crimes, because it's not just the harm of the crime itself. It's also the additional harm of seeing somebody in a position of power, a position of public trust, a position where we as a society have entrusted the police with the ability to wield force responsibly and legitimately, to see that abused and to face that head on for victims, for survivors, for the public as a whole is a rude awakening and something that can shake your sense of trust and your sense of order in society. So we've got to hold police officers accountable. Now, the Ryan Alden case in particular is a difficult example for Kevin Barton, because it's not just that they neglected to charge the jail deputy initially. They affirmatively decided that they would not. They wrote out a memo and made the determination that this was not going to charge this person. And it's not that any facts significantly changed over the course of 2 years. It's not that new evidence came to light. Everything else was available. The person had been harmed. The guy had been put in the hospital. The video was there and they had it. And they decided that there wasn't enough evidence to charge Ryan Alden. And then they reversed course 2 years later, just weeks after George Floyd got murdered by police, and just after the civil lawyer for Mr. Molina publicly released the video, because now the public could see the harm that Mr. Molina suffered. And now, with that public pressure, now their initial determination to look the other way was untenable, and they reversed course and decided to finally charge Ryan Alden for it. And that was in 2020. And it's almost 2 years on now, and the case is still stalled out. It's still on the books. Ryan Alden is still drawing a paycheck from the county taxpayers, and we don't have any resolution of those charges.
So as district attorney, would you recuse yourself in such cases and call for an independent investigative agency to be assigned?
I think that's part of the solution, but I don't think it's the whole solution. I've seen reforms where in cases where the most serious cases, police shootings or deaths of people at the hands of police officers, that those investigations and those determinations should be taken out of the local prosecutor's office hands and put into the state Department of Justice hands. Because theoretically, the State Department of Justice is not going to have as close a relationship with the local police agency as the county prosecutor's office. And that makes a certain amount of sense. But I'd go further than that, because when we have the more routine cases, the less serious, but still very serious cases where people are not killed, but are harmed in the course of an interaction with police, where there's some sort of rough interaction, and you see a case come in where somebody's charged with resisting arrest, but no charge that they were originally being arrested for. And then that person obviously, 9 times out of 10, is going to have bruises and scratches all over their body because it was some rough use of force. Those kinds of cases also need to be investigated by people who are at arm's length from that cozy relationship with police. So I believe that what those kind of more routine cases require is a special division within the district attorney's office that only handles those kinds of cases, and therefore doesn't have the chance to build up that usual working relationship with the law enforcement agencies.
The Oregon Criminal Justice Commission study released in 2019 listed Washington County Sheriff's Office as one of the law enforcement agencies that disproportionately stop people of color at traffic stops. Senate Bill 1510 was just passed by the 2022 Oregon legislature, which will reduce racial disparities in traffic stops by making a single headlight, taillight, or brake light out a secondary offense. Can you talk about the importance of such a law?
I supported 1510. It's a really responsible, reasonable, balanced reform designed to reduce those disparities. And I'm hopeful that it will go at least part of the way in doing what it sets out to do. To clarify, my understanding is that the state data has shown that Washington County Sheriff's Office, when they have drivers stopped, when those drivers are Latinos, Washington County Sheriff's Office, along with the two other largest law enforcement agencies in Washington County, Beaverton Police Department and Hillsborough Police Department, have disproportionately negatively treated Latino drivers during the course of those traffic stops. It's not that they necessarily stopped them disproportionately in the first place, but they've been more likely to search them, more likely to issue citations, and more likely to arrest them during the course of those traffic stops. And that's unfortunately true in a lot of for a lot of agencies nationwide, where we're seeing a disproportionate use of, for instance, searching a car for drugs when it comes to drivers of color than when you're looking at white drivers, even though drugs are more likely to be found in the searches of white drivers than drivers of color. Those kind of outcomes of stops are not directly addressed by this recent legislation because, as you said, the recent legislation makes certain traffic offenses like having one taillight out a secondary offense as opposed to the kind of offense that you can get stopped for in the first place. You can still get a ticket for having your taillight out, but only if you got stopped for something like speeding or running a red light in the first place. And that's important because it's going to, in theory, reduce the incidence of what's called pretextual traffic stops. Pretextual traffic stops are where law enforcement decides that they want to stop somebody for any reason under the sun, a hunch, or in the worst scenario, because the person has the wrong color skin and is driving the wrong car in the wrong neighborhood at the wrong time, and law enforcement decides they want to stop that person. The law says that they're allowed to do it if that's their real reason, so long as they can find a legitimate reason to point to, a pretextual reason to point to. So long as they can say that person had a taillight out, then I'm going to stop that car, even if the real reason for stopping the car wasn't the taillight at all. Even if you go 100 times a day seeing cars with taillights out and you don't stop them, but you're stopping this guy, the law says that's okay. But what this law does is try to reduce the incidence of that happening by saying, we're not going to let you just pull people over for these measly, you know, infractions. Instead, you're going to deal with them as they come up in the course of, you know, interactions that have more to do with actual moving violations or traffic safety, but you're not going to just pull people over because you see something like that. And the Oregon District Attorneys Association has, you know, big surprise, opposed 1510, specifically opposed this traffic stop portion of 1510, and said that, well, those are traffic safety issues and we need to make sure that the police are able to do their job and it's an important part of investigations. But look, I was a federal prosecutor in another state, Arizona, where the law already was on the books looking an awful lot like 1510. You weren't allowed to pull people over for having one taillight out when they had a working taillight in Arizona. And you know what? The sky didn't fall. Law enforcement was still able to pull people over for actual traffic safety violations. They were still able to build criminal cases and stop, you know, and make investigations work. All that happened was that people's rights were protected a little bit more. So that's what 1510 sets out to do, and it's a good idea.
Aid and assist continues to be an issue in Washington County. This is when a person in custody in the county jail is found by the court to be mentally incompetent to aid in their own defense. Now, according to Oregon law, they must be transferred to restorative treatment within 7 days. Instead, they are lingering in the Washington County Jail up to 40 days without treatment. This is due to lack of supports and resources for people with mental illness in the community, but it is also due to the Washington County District Attorney, who chooses to prosecute individuals for low-level, nonviolent crimes who need mental health treatment and not jail.
Yeah. I mean, it's a crisis. We should not be having people with serious mental illness in the jail. And we do. And the jail ends up being one of the largest mental health providers in the county because we're not doing enough to address mental illness in the community. And people spiral, and some percentage of them end up getting arrested for a crime and end up in the jail. And when you don't treat those problems in the community, when you don't invest in that social safety net, then you see them all filter down into the jail, where it is completely ineffective at solving problems, it is inefficient, and it is the most expensive place to try to solve problems. Now, we need more support for the Oregon State Hospital to have more bed space for the people that it needs to be treating. But what we really need even more than that is to have more community support for people who have mental illness, because we wouldn't need to be having all these people waiting around at the jail to go to the state hospital if we had supports in the community that people could be released to have their treatment here in the community. We need a balanced approach that's going to incorporate a lot more treatment options and building up that social safety net that has too long been neglected here in Washington County. And the truth is, it's neglected because it's directly in competition with incarceration and with fanatical criminal justice system and the approach of the district attorney's office to lock up more and more people. It's taking away resources that we need to address those kind of problems in the community. We shouldn't be criminalizing mental illness. We're not going to arrest our way out of the problem of people having serious mental illness. We're not going to incarcerate our way out of the problem of people having serious mental illness. Yes, there are people who are so dangerous, they need to be held apart from the rest of the community. And, you know, that's an unfortunate but true fact. But there's also people that we should be helping and can be helping in the community, and we need to be doing it. We need to not be locking up so many people when the root cause of their problem is something like mental illness. We also need to not be doing it again and again and again for the same people. We need to be getting them into the treatment that's going to solve their problems, rather than just having this revolving door where we hold them for a period of time as punishment, let them out, and then expect somehow something's going to change. No, they just keep coming back through the system. We have the worst rate of recidivism in the metro area here in Washington County because we're not actually rehabilitating people who have underlying problems, and we need to be focusing on that.
Brian, can you give contact information for your campaign?
Absolutely. You can find us on the website, which is deckerforda.com. We are also on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and it is all deckerforda is the handles for each of those. You can also reach out to me at brian@deckerforda.com.
I've been speaking with Brian Decker, candidate for Washington County District Attorney. Thank you so much, Brian, and good luck.
Thank you very much.